Hello, and welcome to the Queen's Observatory Fast Radio Bursts. I am Connor Stone, here with my co-host, Nikhil Arora. It is our mission to bring exciting space news hot off the telescope and into your ears. In one way or another, the Queen's Observatory has continued its practice of sharing the wonders of the universe since 1857. Thank you for joining us in this long-running tradition. Here at Fast Radio Bursts, we will answer your questions, interview astronomers, and dive deep into breaking research. From low Earth orbit to the clouds of Venus, from Betelgeuse to colliding black holes, it's a big universe to talk about, so let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to the first science episode, if I might say, of Queen's Observatory Fast Radio Burst. With me is once again Connor Stone. Hi, Connor.
Hello again.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. It's nice to get into some science now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. Just as a recap, if you haven't heard, our last podcast was sort of laying down the groundwork or telling you about what the mission of the Queen's Observatory and therefore this podcast is, where we are located, what we do. So please go ahead and listen to that podcast if you have any questions about those. But today we're going to be talking about something exciting, something very exciting that happened in the news, which was that there was a really interesting discovery of a gas on Venus. So, Connor, what was the gas?
Well, we've detected phosphine gas, which up until the announcement, I had no idea what that was. But I've been learning as much as I can about it because it's really neat. And looking for life on other planets is a really neat sort of cross-disciplinary challenge for science. You get astronomers, you get chemists, you get biologists involved, geologists, climatologists. It's all over the map. And so it's been fun to kind of dive into this a little bit.
Wow, yeah. Connor, you've been doing a lot of TV interviews and radio interviews with this topic, right? As a part of the Queen's Observatory.
Yeah, Queen's Observatory is sort of Kingston's hub for astronomy news. So whenever something big happens, our phone rings.
Oh, yes. Doesn't it ring? So yeah, one thing we're going to do maybe is if you want to see Connor explain just quickly about what phosphine and what this discovery on phosphine actually means for Venus, we're going to, in the show notes, put some links about where you can find these interviews from Connor. So let's just move on. Let's dive into phosphine on Venus. But before we do that, let's talk about what phosphine is, right? One phosphorus, three hydrogen. That's all I know about it.
Yeah, so that's about how much a lot of people know about it right now. One phosphorus atom, three hydrogen atoms. It's a very simple molecule as far as molecules go, but that's good, because that means that it's relatively easy to understand scientifically.
Right.
So we'll get into some of the chemistry later, but phosphine, it's associated with life here on Earth. And
how?
Specifically, it's associated with decay of biological matter. And we're not 100% sure, like, the exact mechanism where the phosphine gets produced, but it seems to be associated with anaerobic activity. So when there's no oxygen around, which is exciting, and also can be enhanced in a more acidic environment, which is also quite exciting. So why it's exciting, we should probably get into some basics about Venus, because Venus is not Earth.
Yeah. You're not kidding about that. Maybe before we move on to some Venus itself, is there any other way we could create phosphine? I know some of the industry also creates phosphine, right? Is that correct? Because these are the only two viable ways. It's either decomposing like life or a living being or some sort of industry, right?
Yeah. So human activity also produces phosphine. But that's not particularly interesting from a looking for life perspective, at least not on Venus.
That's right.
Because you really can't get you can't have a whole society with factories and everything on Venus.
That's right. Yeah.
We could barely get a lander on there.
Yeah. That is not wrong right there. Okay, let's talk about Venus. It's about the same size as Earth. How far is it from the sun, Connor?
So roughly 100 million kilometers from the sun, which for reference, Earth is 150 million. So it's about two-thirds of the way between the sun and us.
Right, and it's about the same size. What does that mean for the planet as a whole? We know it's a sister planet, right? And it's right outside the habitability zone for sun. Do you want to dive into that a little bit?
So when defining the habitable zone, the zone where one can imagine liquid water forming on the surface of a planet, the boundaries are kind of fuzzy. And Venus is in that fuzzy area of the habitable zone. Earth is perfectly placed. It's wonderful.
But well, Venus, we know that, right?
Venus, if you can imagine an atmosphere that will give it liquid water, but currently it has an atmosphere with like 100 times the pressure here on Earth. It's equivalent to being almost a kilometer underwater. The amount of pressure that you would feel, that's about how much pressure you would feel standing on the surface of Venus. So it's got a really, really thick atmosphere. And so it is very much not in a habitable sort of regime. It's all that thick atmosphere creates a greenhouse gas effect. And so it ends up being super hot, over 450 degrees Celsius on the surface.
Right.
Hot enough to melt certain metals, which was a bit of a problem. When we sent a lander to Venus, it actually only lasted for minutes, hours, a very short period of time before it failed.
That's right.
It was able to send out a couple pictures first, but for the most part, it didn't last. And that's because of the incredible pressure, incredible temperature. And also the atmosphere itself is largely composed of sulfuric acid, which is not great.
No. So
all around, Venus is an inhospitable place, but it's in that boundary, that fuzzy boundary of the habitable zone. So it's possible that in its past, before this greenhouse gas effect really ran away, maybe it had liquid water on its surface and maybe it had better conditions. It's
a big maybe. Let us emphasize that.
It's a big maybe, but it's not implausible. So, I mean, it's fun to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the particularly interesting things that we can think about is if a human was to land on Venus, how would he die? Would he burn because of 450 degrees Celsius temperature? Would he actually get crushed because of the pressure of being almost under 1 kilometer of water? Or would he start dying because of sulfuric acid burning going within his lungs? And I think this is a very interesting, maybe not the best way to start a podcast, but a very interesting thought experiment, right?
Yeah, one quote that I heard from Hank Green, and maybe he got it from someone else, but he said that you would probably die faster on the surface of Venus with a spacesuit than you would on the surface of Mars without a spacesuit.
Yeah,
Mars is cold, but sometimes it even gets up to like a balmy minus 20 degrees Celsius. And so you'd die of asphyxiation on Mars. You would suffocate to death because the atmosphere is so thin. With Venus, there's just so many things coming at you. You won't make it.
Yeah, as you pointed out, it's just, even landing space probes, which are unmanned at this point in time, is just incredibly hard on Venus. So it's an interesting thought experiment, to say the least. So I guess apart from it not being hospitable at all, I think we've emphasized that quite a bit in the first minutes of this show here. Why is it interesting? Why is Venus interesting?
Well, so one reason that Venus is interesting is because it may have had a liquid water surface at one point. And because that's a possible history, that means it's also maybe possible that there was life there at one point. These are all hypotheticals, but we're looking as hard as we can, and we're trying to look where things are interesting and where there's a possibility. So that's a possibility. Yeah. And although Venus's surface is really inhospitable, its atmosphere goes all the way up to space at some point where there's no pressure. So somewhere in the middle, there's a region where the atmosphere is not too intense, 30 degrees Celsius even. Sure, still filled with sulfuric acid. That's something you got to deal with. But not unreasonable as far as conditions go for life here on Earth. 30 degrees Celsius and in an acidic environment, we know that there are bacteria that can survive in that sort of environment. We call them extremophiles, and that's the best place on Venus. But we know that there are things that survive in such conditions.
It's absolutely right. If you can circumvent the sulfuric acid, maybe have a balloon around you. At a 30 degrees Celsius temperature, even humans can survive. And so there have been hypothetical experiments of what would life look like in an aerial city floating up in the sky at the height where the temperature is just right, the pressure is just right for humans to live in, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the pressure is so intense that at some level, you can probably float very large machines in the Venus atmosphere. If you can get them to survive the sulfuric acid, then it could be a pretty great place for astronauts to live.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Enough about the discovery. We're now next going to move... Oh, enough about basic facts about Venus, to be honest. We're now next going to move into the discovery of what phosphine is and why it actually... how it was discovered and why it matters. Okay, great. So, Connor, the discovery. One phosphorus and three hydrogens.
Yeah, so phosphine is detected on Venus at a level of something like 20 parts per billion, plus or minus a little bit, which doesn't sound like a lot, and it's not, but it is a fairly significant quantity of phosphine if you spread that over the whole planet. So phosphine, like any molecule, it emits light when you get it excited, and each molecule emits a certain signature of wavelengths. Phosphine happens to have this certain transition that it can do because of its rotation. It's a bit of an asymmetric molecule, and you can change the amount of rotation it's doing, produce some light, and actually record that signal. The light that it produces is not the kind of light that you and I can see. So phosphine doesn't really glow in the dark, at least not in the traditional way. The wavelength is around 1.123 millimeters. So it's a little bit longer than most types of light that we work with, kind of closer to a radio wavelength.
Right. Yeah. So where was it discovered?
Well, it was discovered in Venus's atmosphere. And specifically, they first used the JCMT telescope, the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, which is on Mauna Kea in Hawaii.
Yeah, in Hawaii, yeah.
And that telescope only had the resolution to basically see the whole planet at once. So they were able to record that there was some phosphine there, but they had really no idea where in the planet it was. And this was back in 2017 when they did these observations. They decided
to... So imagine with the resolution to our speakers, maybe, Connor, is if JCMT sees whole of Venus as one thing, because that's how big the resolution is, or how good the resolution is. Just think about looking at the moon with your phone, but your phone is sort of out of focus in the camera, and all you see is a big white blob. So that's what JCMT would be seeing when it comes to Venus, right?
Yeah, it was basically one big pixel was all they got for having Venus in it.
That's right.
And so that was enough to detect that there's some sort of phosphine there, but they wanted to get some more information about this. And also, analyzing data from a telescope is hard, especially analyzing a spectrum from a telescope. That's so what they decided to do was to use an entirely different telescope to look at it and sort of make a double confirmation that they're actually seeing this gas, because they weren't expecting to see it originally. They sort of wanted to cross it off a list, and then something came up. So they used the ALMA telescope, and the ALMA telescope has much better resolution. They were able to separate out the poles of the planet, the mid area of the planet, and the equator of the planet. And so there they could look at where in the planet they were detecting this phosphine.
That's right.
And what was exciting is where they found it was not at the poles and not really at the equator too much. It was in the sort of mid region bands.
Between the poles and equator.
Midway between the poles and the equator. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason that's exciting is because there are sort of air currents that circulate in Venus between the poles and the equator, but not quite all the way to either one of those. And those currents cycle over and over again. And so you might imagine some sort of particles or little bacteria or something getting caught in droplets and sort of staying in these currents indefinitely at a certain level of the atmosphere.
Yeah. So droplets of sulfuric acid, so not water, sulfuric acid here again.
Sulfuric acid, yes.
Yeah. So let's just some basics about the ALMA telescope. The ALMA stands for Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It is in Chile, and just like the JCMT, it is what we call a radio telescope. So just think about a big dish. And if you've seen Contact, the movie, just think about multiple dishes. And I think maybe we'll get to this in a future episode. But why ALMA was better than JCMT is because it has multiple of those dishes. And so because of that, it can get a better resolution. Is that correct? That's right, right?
That is. I mean, you are also an astronomer.
It's always good to get confirmation from your peer, I guess.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
So as far as detections go, this was actually the first time we had seen phosphine.
Yeah, that's right.
So astronomers have known about phosphine on other planets for a while, specifically the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn. We have detected phosphine on those, I think, since the 90s. But the difference is we know how phosphine would be produced on those planets. They have very hydrogen-rich atmospheres, and phosphine is three parts hydrogen to one part phosphorus. And in the incredible pressures deeper in those planets and those gas giants, you can actually force phosphine to be produced. And then all you need is a little bit of a wind to sort of dredge it up, bring it up to the surface, and then we can measure it. So phosphine produced on these gas giants is not a big deal. But the atmosphere of Venus doesn't actually have a lot of hydrogen in it.
Well, let's go back to these gas giants. Yes, you just said these gas giants, such as Jupiter and Saturn, are rich in hydrogen. The phosphorus actually comes into the gas giant through asteroids and meteors, right? That's how the phosphorus needs to be transformed in or put into place.
Yeah, phosphorus on its own doesn't really form a gas. It forms solids. Yeah. So you do need a sort of constantly replenishing source. But there's no shortage of meteorites in our solar system.
You're not wrong about that. And a lot of asteroids move towards Jupiter because it's so big. So the gravitational field the gravitational pull is really strong. So it does invite into itself a lot of asteroids and meteors.
And may even be protecting the Earth from asteroids, but that's a whole different topic.
As I've said in some of my previous past talks, Jupiter and Earth sort of have a frenemy relation because it really protects the Earth because of its gravitational dominance with from asteroids. But every now and then it will send one our way. And as you said, that's a different topic we'll dive into in the future. But for now, yeah, that's how phosphorus, getting back to the topic, of course, that's how phosphorus gets into Jupiter for phosphine to be made.
And of course, some of it, some of the phosphorus on Venus comes from meteorites as well.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that they looked at when they tried to explain where this phosphine is coming from.
Yeah.
So maybe we should talk a little bit about that next. Is what are the ways that we're producing phosphine on Venus?
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some of the ways we're producing phosphines on Venus, Connor?
So you can break it down by different sources. And as part of the research that these scientists did, they brought in a chemist and said, all right, let's think of all the different ways that we can imagine to produce phosphine. And they considered meteorites, they considered lightning, which may inject enough energy to sort of cause some chemical reactions to happen. They also considered different sorts of chemical reactions that could happen on the surface of rocks, at the surface of Venus. And what they realized is it's actually fairly hard to produce phosphine in Venus's atmosphere. You can record the temperature and pressure conditions at different layers of the atmosphere and see, well, maybe one layer of the atmosphere is going to produce more than the other. And that's true. Phosphine is probably produced more in some layers of the atmosphere than others.
Yeah.
But there's a big issue that phosphine is a pretty simple, small little molecule, and it's easy to break up. So whenever the phosphine gets high enough in the Venus atmosphere, it gets broken down almost immediately from light from the sun.
Yeah.
Like 15 minutes. It only lasts like 15 minutes when it's way up in the upper atmosphere. But you'd probably produce it in lower parts of the atmosphere. So maybe it could survive down there. So they figured out what the mixing time is. How long it takes a phosphine atom produced in the lower parts of the atmosphere to make its way to the upper atmosphere. And that they found was of the order around 1,000 years. So what that means is basically any phosphine in the atmosphere can't live longer than 1,000 years, because no matter where you make it, eventually it works its way up to the upper atmosphere, at least for a little while, and gets destroyed.
But how easy would it be for you to make phosphine? Because you said some of the ways it couldn't be made is through rocks, but rocks cannot live in the atmosphere, right?
Right. Well, phosphine is a gas. So as soon as you produce it, it gets carried away by wind.
But the pressure is so strong that something from the surface presumably will take a long time to make its way up to where phosphine was found, right?
Well, There's various sources of wind on Venus, and so you end up with it being somewhere around 1,000 years. So if you create the phosphine on the surface, then it's a gas, so it goes into the atmosphere, and within 1,000 years, it makes its way up for at least a little while to the upper atmosphere and gets destroyed. So once they worked that out, they knew how long the phosphine could survive, and if you look at the paper, they show this incredibly long chain involving dozens of molecules where they considered basically any different combination of phosphorus and hydrogen and maybe some other atoms that come in halfway through, and all these different pathways that the chemistry could produce phosphine. And they took that model and ran it with Venus's atmosphere and tried to see if they could get enough phosphine produced that it would overcome this 1,000 year boundary.
Yeah.
And to the best that they could figure out, it was off by like 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times for some sources. So there was no way that they could come up with, that these chemists could come up with, to produce phosphine in any significant quantities that wouldn't be destroyed within this lifetime of 1,000 years.
Yeah. So Connor, you pointed out the paper. Before we get back into the science, maybe I'll point out for those keeners out there, the ones that are really, really interested, we'll put a link to the paper in the show notes as well so that they can go see for themselves.
Yeah, and they've got some great pictures, like figures in there that are fun to look at, actually.
Yeah.
If you're into science.
If you're into science. So the keeners will definitely get a link to the paper, the actual paper. Okay, going back to the science, essentially, you pointed out that all of the waste that phosphine could be produced here, there on Venus, cannot actually account for it staying there for 1,000 years. And this might, maybe I'll take us away from the idea, because I think we're going back to the idea of there being life on Venus. And this, before we do that, this might also have some interesting implications for the chemists out there, because this might be some new chemistry that you cannot produce either in the lab or naturally on Earth, right?
Well, that's really the big discovery, is at this stage, we have something that we don't understand. And one possible explanation is that it's life. But another one that's very compelling is maybe there's some pathway, some bit of chemistry that we don't know about yet. And if we knew that, we would be able to come up with a chemical pathway that produces phosphine enough to explain this 20 parts per billion abundance that we're seeing in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So what I love about this science is that it's exciting either way. Either we've detected life and it's truly amazing, or we've detected new chemistry. And that's also like, that's a really hard thing to do, because we've been doing chemistry for a long time and we kind of understand a lot of how it works.
Yeah. And at this point of time, maybe putting forward, if you and I both were betting people, we would not put our bets on the life part. We would definitely go with that.
I mean, there's certainly more ways for this to be new chemistry than there are for it to be life. As we've already explained, Venus is quite an inhospitable environment.
150 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. But these chemists really did try their best and can fairly confidently say that they were not able to find any way to get close to the abundance that we're seeing. So we're pretty much guaranteed that there's something new there. There's something that we haven't discovered yet going on. Whatever it is, is going to be exciting.
Yeah, which is the more exciting part for sure. Yeah. Okay. So what would life look like if it was on Venus? I know we're going back to life again, but
I mean, you got to go back to the life.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the more exciting, maybe slightly by a little bit.
Exciting. Even if it's only a 1% chance, it's worth a 1% chance is like hard to come by for life in the universe.
Yeah.
If we look at the moon, I'd put it at less than a 1% chance that there's life hanging out on the moon, except for maybe some tardigrades that we left there.
Oh, there was water recently found, or rusting of metal on moon.
There was rust. And there's
which would indicate some sort of oxygen process, or it might just have come from some asteroid. For a different podcast once again. So what would life actually look like on Venus?
Yeah, so it'd have to be pretty different from what we see here on Earth. It would have to survive in a sulfuric acid environment, which there are bacteria that can survive in acidic environments, but this is pretty intense. So these would be classified as extremophiles. It would have to live its entire life in the atmosphere and maybe deal with sometimes falling down out of its comfortable 30 degree region of the atmosphere and maybe falling down into less hospitable areas
every now and then. Just maybe, so one thing that I can point out is we're talking about this 30 degree region in the atmosphere. For a reference, that's about 50 kilometers above or 30 miles above the surface of Venus. Venus is as big as Earth is. Therefore, the gravitational sorry, the gravitational acceleration or the pull from Venus is about the same. So staying 50 kilometers above ground, as you said, for a bacteria might not be that easy as
it,
well.
Yeah, it might not be easy. So they've got to kind of deal with that. The astronomers, when they made this big announcement live, they took a bit of time at the end to just kind of speculate and say, like, hey, let's do some hypothesizing here. What would this life look like? And they imagined that it would have a spore stage. So if it fell too low, it could revert back to a spore that's much more hardy, that can survive in harsher conditions, by temperature. And it would stay in that spore stage until it makes its way back up, finds a nice sulfuric acid droplet to go in and sort of rehydrates it. And then it would come back to its regular activity, which is quite a remarkable life cycle. But not unheard of. Like, there are bacteria that we know of that when conditions get very dry, they can sort of dehydrate themselves and survive for a long time.
Yeah.
Until they come across some water again. That's tardigrades.
Yes.
So it's not, none of the parts are unheard of. They're all just individually extraordinary, and getting them all together would also be quite extraordinary.
I think by this time the listeners do realize how big odds life on Venus is facing. If this is actually life, this is some huge odds that we're putting in front of life to be on Venus.
Yep, but it's exciting enough that we're going to have to do some more. We're going to have to keep looking at Venus to try and understand what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, so as you said, there's still a lot more to do, right, Connor? What's in the future for phosphine on Venus?
Well, now that Venus is everyone's favorite planet, we're going to be looking at it very closely with all the telescopes we've got, and we're probably going to be studying the concentration of phosphine over the course of a Venus year and see if that changes. And maybe that'll give us some more information about the weather on Venus, and maybe more information about what sort of cycles we can see. Maybe during the Venus summer, whatever that looks like, there's more phosphine, and that might indicate, oh, wait, there's more activity of something going on. Chemical reactions always go faster when it's warmer.
Heat. Yeah.
So maybe there's some sort of information we can get there. We can also do a little bit more work to study the different layers of the Venus atmosphere and see where the phosphine really is. And ideally, at some point, we would send a probe to Venus and go check it out and actually say sort of definitively what's going on in its atmosphere.
That is if the probe survives, of course.
Yeah, and how that probe works would have to be pretty special. It might have to float in the Venus atmosphere, or it might have to work really fast before it overheats.
But yeah, all of these are really, really exciting avenues going down for science, right? Whether it's sending a probe to Venus or continuously looking for 225 days, which is sort of a Venus year, this is something super exciting, and it involves all areas of science, right? This is not just chemists sitting and looking at things. You need astronomers, you need engineers to send probes up there, and other scientists like biologists, and you pointed out geologists as well, right?
Exactly. You need a lot of people working together, and we need a lot more work on this topic. So this is really exciting, and I hope that someday we're going to do another podcast with a big update, whatever that big update is.
Yeah,
about
some new understanding in chemistry.
Yeah.
That life sitting right next door,
which would be pretty remarkable. And that's something I should probably say as well, is if we discovered life on Venus, because of how inhospitable it is, it would completely change our ideas of what life in the universe is like. It would it would potentially indicate that life is much more common than we ever thought before, because we would have to expand what we consider the habitable zone to be. No one would naturally put the habitable zone at 450 degrees Celsius. But if we did discover life on Venus, we'd have to acknowledge that life can exist in a far larger range of environments than we originally thought, than we think of here on our very nice and calm Earth.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, and maybe one thing to emphasize over here once again is this is life, not intelligent life. This is what we call bacteria and microbes, and not fully functioning humans doing calculus at 50 kilometers altitude on Venus.
Yeah, that's true. That might still be very rare, because we need everything to line up just right. But I think it would still be exciting, even bacterial life existing on other planets. There'd be a lot to learn there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, thank you, Connor, for leading us through this. This was our first podcast that brought together the very exciting discovery of finding phosphine, which until maybe a week ago, we knew was just 3 hydrogens and 1 phosphorus, but something so simple can be so exciting. And that's sort of the nature of science. So yeah, thanks, Connor.
Yeah, this was fun.
Yeah, we'll be back again soon with some more exciting things in astronomy and talk about it and dive deeper into it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We hope you enjoyed this walk through the universe. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact us via email at queensuobservatory@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter as the Queen's University Observatory to stay up to date. If you like this podcast, you can help us by leaving a review and sharing it with your friends. This will help us become more visible and spread the wonders of the universe to more people. That is all from us. We'll be back again with another exciting topic in astronomy.